Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May the 5th, 2018. My Dhamma talk in our Sangha discussions is on the Anuradha Sutta. In this sutta, Anuradha learns from the Buddha how to teach an authentic Dhamma and avoid the distraction of trying to satisfy answers to these great existential questions. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is on the Anuradha Sutta. It's another sutta where the great existential questions come up and how to what to do about them. It's a slightly different scene. Last week's sutta, the Vajragoda Sutta, was the Buddha talking directly to Vajragoda about his confused thinking and these existential questions that he thinks needed to be answered before he would believe that the Buddha was somebody who was awakened. And eventually he came to understand from the Buddha's direct words where his foolish thinking, where his confused thinking was. In this sutta, Anuradha is approached by a small group of wandering ascetics, but with the same questions. And they put these questions to Anuradha. Let me just read it.
Slowly.
Slowly. Whenever you say that, I think of that old Taxi. Remember Taxi?
Yeah.
Great show. Where Jim Ignatowski was taking his driver's test. And he said, "What does a yellow light mean?" And I think it was, one of them said, "Slow down." "What does..." "Slow down." "What?" The things you remember, the things my conditioned mind holds in place as important. The Tathagata, the group asked Anuradha, the awakened one, has been described as having one of these views. The awakened one exists after death. The awakened one does not exist after death. The awake one, the word that they're using in the sutta is the Tathagata, but that's what it means. The awakened one both exists and does not exist after death. Now we're really getting into the weeds, aren't we? And then this is taking that existential idea one step further. The awakened one neither exists nor does not exist after death. Figure that one out. That last one is a very common view that allows for any possibility for establishing a self. And if you answer yes to those, or even speculate that these must be true, you've now created a repository for a permanent self or a permanent soul. And that's the reason why that is that last, I want to use the word foolish, that last conflicting statement is really the end result or the purpose of modern Mahayana Buddhism. And I'm not putting it down. It's just it's exactly how this has developed. When the split between the original Sangha and the Mahasanghikas took place, it was exactly because of these great existential questions that they wanted their religion to answer. And when you look at most religions, and again, religion has served a great purpose. I'm gonna put that out there. I'm not putting down religions, but most religions have been formed so they can provide seemingly reasonable answers to these great existential questions as a way of proving that they're a useful religion. Mm-hmm. The Buddha felt no need to do that because he never saw himself as a savior when he wasn't trying to establish a salvific religion. He was simply trying to describe, you'll hear me say this again at the end of the sutta, he was merely trying to describe the nature of suffering and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So these great existential questions just simply have no relevance. The Buddha never says that they're true or not true. In fact, he's very clear. Remember Vajragoda? He simply responded no. He didn't get into a debate as to why these aren't true, because even the debate is a further distraction from the truth, isn't it? And we do that with our minds. That's where these questions ultimately come from. It's a debate that we have within our minds, and then we form our associations and we create agreement with our debate, and so then we have these strong formations, mental fabrications that are formed. This last is a good example of that aggregate of mental fabrications or assumptions. because we can't describe a way for a self to be permanent all throughout all the different realms and lifetimes and all that, we create scenarios to establish that, and then between association and common agreement, they become the truth. So that's what's happened here. Venerable Anuruddha replied that the awakened one is not described as having any of these views. So they're trying to pin the Buddha down to having one of these views, which will show what his underlying philosophy is. Because all the great spiritual teachers of that time had one or all of these views. In fact, one of the great Zen and Mahayana, meaning Tibetan, teachers in the 5th century or so, Nagarjuna, you look him up, he's regarded as one of the foremost Buddhists of all time. And his entire teaching can be boiled down to that last. And I'm greatly simplifying his teachings, which are very intricate, but he's basically saying that we both exist and do not exist concurrently. And the reason why he's come to that conclusion, when you read his works, you realize that this is an incredibly brilliant man, but because his thinking was rooted in initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths, he naturally had to come to this conclusion to reconcile all these beliefs, because there's no other way to reconcile except to say we're all in this big amorphous soup, which is the same thought. That last line in this thought that we're all one universal organism, or we're evolving as one gigantic cosmic consciousness, comes from that same belief too. And it's something that, whether that's true or not, again, it's irrelevant whether it's true or not, so we can avoid the debate. It's completely irrelevant to awakening. That's all. That's why we shouldn't even consider it. It's just not important. Why waste mental energy? So Anuruddha gave that answer. You can't describe the awakened one as having any of these views. The wandering group said to Anuruddha, "You are either an inexperienced newcomer or simply a foolish elder." And they got up in a huff and left. He didn't give them the answer they wanted. They didn't realize that sitting in front of them was someone who could answer every one of their questions if they frame the questions properly. And that's where the Buddha gets to. Not long after, Anuruddha thought, "If I'm questioned again by seekers, how will I answer in such a way that will not misrepresent the Buddha's Dhamma, and so that those whose thinking is in line with the Dhamma will have grounds for criticizing me?" In other words, he knows that he's going to approach the Buddha now, and he does not want to be criticized by the Buddha, but not from a self-referential point, not because he doesn't want to be put down, because he's so intent on presenting an authentic Dhamma. He doesn't want to fall into a situation where he won't know what to say again, and people will leave. He'll lose the opportunity to present the Dhamma. Anuruddha went to the Buddha. He bowed and sat to one side, and he said, "Great teacher, a group of wandering sectarians asked me if you had any views that agree with these views." And then he repeated those views. "And I said to them, 'Friends, the awakened one is not described as having any of these views. They assumed I was an inexperienced newcomer or a foolish elder. I misrepresented your Dhamma. How should I respond in the future to present your authentic Dhamma so that I won't be criticized by the wise?'" It's an interesting and important question, isn't it? How many of you have been asked, what are you doing there at that crazy center in Frenchtown? And how do you describe it? And it's a hard question to ask for a few reasons. One is, depending on who is asking us, we might not want to identify ourselves as foolish people that sit quietly on Saturday mornings, because there's other people that will criticize you for that. Some of it is just that we really don't know how to respond and how to put what we've learned in the right context. The best response is really what the Buddha gives here, and it's that what we're learning is how to understand the ever-changing nature of the world we live in and the views that we have of ourselves.
Bless you.
And that's really the Dhamma. He's describing the insight that we gain through the Dhamma is into the three marks of existence, isn't it? That's the insight that the Buddha is hoping to teach. Not insight into washing dishes or anything else, or even an insight into these great questions. Insight into the impermanent nature of all things, the misunderstanding of the not-self, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. That's the Buddha's Dhamma. That's what he's teaching us to gain insight. So whether I exist after death or I not exist after death is completely irrelevant, isn't it? Even if it's true, even if I could say, I know for a fact, somehow, that we both exist and do not exist after death. And you believe me because of my credentials, because so many other people follow me. You are now deeply conditioned and established in ignorance, because it's an ignorant view. And so the Buddha wouldn't even speculate to leave any hook, any little shred that we could attach ourselves to. He would often say to Vajragupta, remember from last week, it's your questions that confuse you. Let go of the questions. The questions are irrelevant. But when anatta, when a self-referential ego personality has any thought, because that thinking process is rooted in ignorance, that thought is a clinging thought. It's the self is now attached to the thought. That's why I say that anatta must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs, or it feels threatened. There's great fear. Where am I in this? And so these questions arise from that. What happens to me? I can deal with awakening right now, but my big concern is what happens in my next life, because that's usually how this is taught, salvation. If you do all the right things now, your next life, or in maybe a million future lives, eventually you'll develop the conditions for one favorable life out of millions. It's kind of a miserable prospect, isn't it? And the Buddha said that's not true. You can develop lasting peace and happiness in this life, in this moment, whenever you're ready to do it. And the way to do it is directly through the Eightfold Path. So now the Buddha's listened to this, and he understands, because this is a common problem that he's faced with all the time. And he knows that there's no reason to get into debate about why we shouldn't talk about those questions, or even to create too rigid of a structure of Anuruddha, this is what you should say. What he tells Anuruddha is, what he teaches Anuruddha is the Dhamma in a simple enough way that he can now give it to other people. The Buddha responds, what do you think, Anuruddha? Is form permanent or impermanent? So what were the questions? Does the awakened one exist after death? Does he not exist after death? Does it, that concurrent confusion, is that part of it? The Buddha didn't answer any of those questions, did he? He completely dismissed them for a purpose, to show how irrelevant they are. He didn't even address it. Here's the answer to your question, Anuruddha. Is the awakened one... is the awakened one's form permanent or impermanent? Has no relation to those questions at all, does it? On the surface, but on a very subtle and deep level, it's the answer to the questions. The answer is, let him go. And he gets directly to that point here. It takes Anuruddha a little while to realize that's what he's teaching. Anuruddha answers, form is impermanent, Master. And is that which is impermanent stressful or useful? That which is impermanent is stressful. You remember, well, some of you might remember from retreat, the teaching on the Anulakkhana, well, I've given it here too, the Anulakkhana Sutta, the Sutta on the Not-Self Characteristic, where the Buddha concludes that sutta by saying, if it's impermanent, how could it be a self? And to recognize that what is impermanent cannot constitute a self. How could it, if it's always changing? How can you, meaning a fixed permanent self, how could it be? If it's always changing, it can't be a fixed and permanent substantial self that would migrate as an individual soul from one life to the next, to the left, next to the next. Understanding the Dhamma, understanding impermanence, shows that that's just not possible. It's not even, it doesn't relate to the Dhamma in any way. And is it authentic to my Dhamma to join with what is stressful, to self-identify with what is stressful, by regarding what is impermanent or stressful, subject to change, as this is me, this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, it is not, Master. So Anuruddha has developed the Dhamma. This isn't his first encounter with the Buddha. He understands the context of what the Buddha is teaching, and on his own individual level, he's developed it to a great extent. He's just not ready to teach it up until now, because he doesn't understand how important and how well focused a mind needs to be framed by the Eightfold Path. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Feeling is impermanent, Master. Is perception permanent or impermanent? Perception is impermanent, Master. Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Fabrications are impermanent, Master. And is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Consciousness is impermanent, Master. What does that refer to? These five references that the Buddha...
Five clinging memories.
Yes. The Buddha's directly relating these great existential questions back to, if you want to understand these questions, or you want to get the answer to these questions, bring this back into understanding five clinging aggregates. Because the five clinging aggregates, when we truly understand them, is an understanding of the three marks within the five clinging aggregates. In other words, the five clinging aggregates contain the experience of impermanence, the misunderstanding of a self, and dukkha. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. Am I going too fast?
No.
Okay, thanks.
But you're
I'm getting too excited?
Well, it's when you read.
Okay, here I...
Your explanations are helping.
Call me Ignatowski when I start reading fast and I'll slow down.
Ignatowski.
And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful, that which is impermanent is stressful, Master? And is it authentic with my Dhamma to join with... And he's going over this again and again, but he's making a point. And is it authentic to my Dhamma to join with what is stressful, to self-identify with what is stressful, by regarding what is impermanent, stressful, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, it is not, Master. You remember when we went through the series of talks on restraint, etc.? And it's at that point of contact with the outside world that we're to practice restraint. And the way to do that is when we find ourselves getting caught up in the world, our mind is reacting in some way, just simply remind ourselves that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And it immediately begins to bring peace and calm to the situation. Because we're intentionally not self-identifying with whatever's arising. And again, that's what the Buddha is referring to here. So Anuruddha, do you regard form as the awakened one, as the Tathagata? No, I do not. So again, coming back, that just previous explanation is also pointing towards impermanence, isn't it? And now he's deepening the connection to five clinging aggregates. No, I do not, Master. Do you regard perception as a Tathagata? Meaning creating an identity over simply what we're seeing. That this form, that's the Buddha. Or what these groups wanted to do, describing the Buddha as having one of these views, would be seeing the Buddha as perception, as what he's presenting. The same thing with fabrications, the same thing with consciousness. And that's, so I'll avoid reading that again. Then the Buddha says, do you view the awakened one as being other than form? Meaning, well, okay, I'm teaching you that the form is not the Buddha. Are you speculating in your mind, okay, well, if he's not that, he must be this? Because that's the same trap. Trying to describe something that is always in a constant change, a constant state of flux, as permanent, as fixed in self, as this or that. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. And again, this is that great problem of anatta, of a mind rooted in ignorance, seeking to establish itself in everything. Mm-hmm. And so that leads to what we talk about a lot here, that feeling of annihilation when we finally understand where this is taking us. But all we're doing is ending clinging. We're not eliminating ourselves from the world. In fact, we're in the world in a way that's free of clinging, meaning that we are free. We're living in the world, but we're not attached to the world. That's what the Buddha means when he says, I've left the world behind. He said that at the age of 36, and yet he lived for 45 more years. He certainly didn't vanish, did he? I think he lived the most effective life that a human being ever lived, by leaving the world behind. And he's teaching every one of us to do that. Now, we don't have to go live in the forest for the rest of our lives to do that. Some of the great awakened people stayed in the world and were responsible for the spread of Buddhism, such as Anathapindika, and 300 years later, King Ashoka, who converted to Buddhism. And if it wasn't for King Ashoka, the Buddhist teachings would have been lost, because he made it a concerted effort to preserve the Buddhist teachings because he was so taken by it. In fact, there's still rock edicts. One of these days I'm going to give a talk on these. Rock edicts all around northern India and even in Sri Lanka that they attribute to King Ashoka, maintaining the Dhamma at that time. So again, the Buddha asked those same questions. Do you view the Tathagata as being in feeling, as being other than feeling, as being in perception, as being other than perception, as being in fabrications, as being other than fabrications, as being in consciousness, or being outside or other than consciousness? And now Anuruddha says, no, I do not, Master. Anuruddha, do you view the Tathagata, the awakened one, as five clinging aggregates, as form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness? No, I do not, Master. Do you view the Tathagata as without form, without feeling, without perception, without fabrications, without consciousness. Now, you see again that this back and forth, that if it's not this, it must be that. There's got to be some way, this feverish way to establish the Tathagata or myself in some realm, in one of these aggregates. When doing so, either not form or is form, is establishing something permanent, isn't it? It's making a declaration that, okay, the Buddha is not form. An awakened human being isn't form anymore. So they have to be not form. It's wrong, isn't it? We're always in a process of becoming. And part of and that process is occurring in the human realm, which is the only realm that the Buddha was concerned about, even though he did mention other realms. The aspiration to other realms is what most religions, including the religions that the Buddha studied, teach us to aspire to. In other words, this life is suffering. Right? This life is suffering, but if you do good works, you'll get rewarded for your suffering in a future life. In Christian religions, it's usually one life. In most Buddhist religions, it could be endless lives. But the answer is the same. The Buddha said, that's not true. We can establish lasting peace and happiness, great fulfillment, in this life as our life unfolds. That was his whole teaching. He was not concerned about dismissing this human life because he had the great understanding that this is the only life we have to deal with. Whether we have an endless number of physical lives isn't important because that's just a distraction. Our life can only occur whether we have one or endless lives. We can only live our life as it unfolds. And the great distraction and the preoccupation with dukkha arising in ignorance forces us to live in the past or in the future and very rarely be present for our own life. That's conditioned thinking. And that's why there's always stress. I think it was you or maybe Diane this morning that talked about, Diane mentioned that at times she just feels the stress in her body. Well, that's the stress that we're all living with. That's that underlying stress. It's what medical science has found out in the last 25 or 30 years, how debilitating the effects of stress are. And it's not the obvious stress that might lead to some trauma, and that's bad enough, but it's the underlying stress that that continually conditions our mind towards more ignorant and stressful thinking. And so unless there's, and this, again, this is what the Buddha awakened to. How do we get ourselves out of this? And remember the Nagara Sutta, how the Buddha described his own thinking process rooted in this type of thinking. How do we get out of this when our minds are stuck in this feedback loop of ignorant views? First, we need to find a way to concentrate that mind, to quiet it down a little bit so that it can see what it's doing. That's why we use meditation, to deepen concentration. And for no other reason. Now, do you see in this context that if we use meditation to generate experiences, whether out-of-body experiences or to connect with my guru worship or connect with it, or any other thing that we might use meditation, is just another form of escape then, isn't it? It's avoiding deepening concentration. So the Buddha taught meditation for one purpose, because it fit in with the Eightfold Path, to deepen concentration. And out of that deepening concentration, we're able to hold in mind the refined mindfulness of the entire framework of the Eightfold Path. That's all that he ever taught. And he taught it for this very specific reason, to avoid ongoing ignorance rooted in speculation, to put our minds into reality and see life as life occurs. So again, we can't do that in the future. No matter how hard we might study, no matter how many great teachers we find, if we're always putting our awakening in the future, we're never going to get there, are we? Because just that motivation is rooted in ignorance. When we realize the profound teaching that an awakened human being gave, the secret is that awakening happens now. We have to be present for it to be here, or we won't notice it. All right. The Buddha makes that point maybe better than I do. So the Buddha goes through that, with form, without form, with perception, without perception, etc., etc. So Anuruddha, when you cannot describe or establish the Tathagata, the awakened one, as a permanent truth in this present life, again, a permanent truth, meaning attached to one of these things that we identify people with. So form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and ongoing thinking. If you think about how we describe other people, by that way, we often describe people by their physical appearance, don't we? They're tall, they're short, they're this, they're that, skin color, you know, that's been a big one since the beginning of humankind. We want to fix people into form. And then we might describe people by the feeling that they create in us or the feeling that they carry. How many people do we describe as, oh yeah, I know that person, they're always angry? Well, that's fitting that person into the feeling, is it? Or we might describe someone by the views they hold. I hate that person because they're a Republican. Or I hate that person because they're a Democrat. Or they're an independent, which is probably even worse to most people today. Can't be independent. That's fixing somebody with a perception, or the next step from a perception, a fabrication. And it doesn't allow us to see another person as in a constant, as a, at least having the potential to be in a constant process of growth and change too. So we fix other people by this way of pigeonholing them, or we describe somebody by the way that they think. And boy, do we do that all the time today, don't we? We think we know enough just by looking at another person and listening to a few things they say, is we can describe how they think now. And we know every thought that they're going because of the assumptions, the fabrications that we've now made. And it creates this incredible feedback loop that the Buddha describes prior to his awakening. It describes the feedback loop that we all get stuck in by insisting, by creating views rooted in ignorance and then insisting that those views are right and they're fixed. And then we have to defend those views once we've developed them and acquired them. And it's those same views that on an individual level cause us to quarrel with our neighbor, as on a national or a global level cause us to have wars. It's the same thing, and it's all rooted in ignorance. Is that clear too?
Mm-hmm.
It could be a big grasp to describe all the world's problems as ignorance, but it really is when you look at it, isn't it? A person who's no longer rooted in ignorance could not possibly have any aggression towards anybody or another nation. Could not possibly see, let me use it as an example, a president that they think is awful as overreacting because they understand the impermanent nature, when they'd be able to see a progression of leaders that none of who were perfect, and that we live in a society that gets to decide who's going to lead them for a couple of years. That's all that this is. And again, I said this when all this stuff came, when it erupted after Trump's election. It's just a 4-year deal, and there really is so much negative that any president can do. I'm not trying to defend Trump either. What I am defending, though, is the country that he's leading. And I've been thinking a lot about this, and it kind of woke me up. I had a little thought last night, which doesn't happen to me. Happens rarely to me. As a country, we've been around less than 300 years. Is that right? Less than 300 years. And we have made incredibly remarkable progress on improving the human condition, more so than any other country that I can think of, especially a country as large as ours. We allow for great freedoms in this country. Most countries, even if they're democratized, don't have the kind of freedoms that we have here. And there's many countries that we know there's no freedom at all. They're complete dictatorships, and people live awful, horrible lives. One of the reasons why they want to come here, right? I'm not saying that we are perfect, but this country in a few hundred years has come further than established countries with thousands and thousands of years of history. So to look at it that way, this great experiment is working. It doesn't mean that we don't have a long way to go. There's still the common problems in this country, aren't there? But we have come such a long way. We had a discussion last week, about racism in this country. And we have come such an, in my lifetime, I'll be 63 in September. The changes in racial inequality and racial hatred in this country has improved dramatically. The problem is that it's still so prevalent, and the idea, even just a little bit of racism, is so hateful, so contrary to humanity, that even a little bit seems unacceptable, and it seems like we haven't gone as far as we have. But we have. I grew up in a town in Berkeley Heights, 20 miles from here. in my lifetime, if you were of the wrong color, you couldn't buy a house in Berkeley Heights. It was a concerted effort among realtors to steer people down the hill to Scotts Plains or Plainfield. The same was true in Clark. In fact, the realtors in Clark got in trouble because they were taking the court. The people in Clark were taking people, you know, drive down the road to Edison, etc., if you were the wrong color. This is in my lifetime. The first black family that ever moved into Berkeley Heights, they were so happy to be in this great little town. They woke up the next morning and their house was painted for free by their neighbors, all different colors, and not very carefully. You know, people took cans of paint and spliced it over the house. This is in my lifetime. That would happen still in some parts of the world, I guess, today, but it wouldn't happen in Berkeley Heights anymore. It wouldn't happen in Clark. We have come a long way. We have a long way to go. And I'm sorry for getting off the point, but it's that type of thinking that leads to all of the troubles in the world. And so it's not too simplistic to think that. In fact, it's important to think that because that points the world to a solution. I don't know that that's ever going to happen. But. And in fact, when I think about what the Buddha described as dukkha occurs as a consequence of living in this world, and his Dhamma is teaching us to not keep creating the conditions to be born again in this world, it may just be that until the universe explodes, and scientists say at some point all this is just going to be, this is impermanent too, it just might be that, you know, that the planet Earth never gets to that globally awakened state, but that doesn't really matter. And again, it's not something the Buddha ever taught. What is most important, and it's the only thing that could lead to a globally awakened state, is if individuals awaken. Because there's no way to establish awakening, is there? The Buddha would have done it 2,600 years ago. There's certainly no way to legislate awakening. Can't do it. I mean, legally in this country, we probably couldn't do it. I mean, if anybody tried, imagine if somebody said, this isn't religion, but we've really found that there's this great teaching that can liberate us all. Everybody should start learning what the Buddha taught beginning in grade school. Can't do that. That's a religion. Let me finish the sutta and I'll comment some more. So Anuruddha, when you cannot describe or establish the Tathagata as a permanent truth in this present life, it is authentic for you to declare that the awakened one has any of these qualities you describe. And I'm just rereading this to get back into context. No, it is not, Master. Anuruddha, you have learned well. Remember what I teach. At all times, it is only stress, it is only dukkha that I describe, and the cessation of dukkha, nothing more. The Buddha said that repeatedly throughout his career, to keep the mind pointed toward, focused on the goal, rather than getting caught up. It is only dukkha that I describe. I don't describe these other things. I don't describe myself as these other things. I describe suffering. And I describe the cessation of suffering. Again, there's many people who would think that, well, that's too simplistic, isn't it? There's so much more that we should be concerned about until we understand. And this is why this is dismissing the Buddha's teaching out of ignorance or indifference, which is one of the hindrances. Rather than looking at something not from a religious point of view, from a practical point of view. Because if we realize, if we start looking at world just not from a, I'm not talking about an awakened Buddhist perspective, simply from a practical perspective, we'll realize that, yeah, I've been a little preoccupied with the suffering, with not getting what I want, with getting what I don't want. I've been a little preoccupied with sickness. I've been a little preoccupied with the idea of aging, and I'm terrified of dying. It's Buddha's description of dukkha. And most of us are that way. I can tell you that until I came to the Dhamma, I had a great fear of death, like everybody else, but it was only because I didn't understand it. I thought that there was either something awful that would happen to me because, I mean, I was brought up Roman Catholic, so no matter what I did in my life, I was going to be spending some time in purgatory. And that was an unpleasant thought. And it wasn't until I realized that none of that really matters if I can develop happiness in this lifetime. And so when I started developing the Buddha's Dhamma, that idea of fear of death, it just doesn't, and I'm closer now than I've ever been. Although we all are, you know, we never know, like Bahia, you know, the cow's gonna come and get all of us at some point. And that understanding should lead us to the immediacy of dukkha. Now is the time to meditate. I always say that. Now is the time to awaken. Why put it off? Why continue dukkha? Why continue to struggle? The Buddha would often describe awakening as this way, putting down the burden. The not-self-characteristic is the burden that we carry. And when we recognize what the Buddha taught, if it's impermanent, it can't be me, and everything that we live in is impermanent, we know that, that's a proven physical fact, how could this be me? Why should I attach myself to me? The answer is in a profound understanding of impermanence. And that leads to the understanding of, well, what am I then? A practical way of looking at it is, well, then what I am is in a constant process of becoming because I'm in impermanence. Look out to understand what's going on with us in that way. Sometimes it is helpful to look out at the world in a metaphorical way. And so you can look at anything out in nature, a good lesson here, anything in nature, look at it. It's always changing. In fact, that's really where the beauty in nature comes, or the maybe even more than that, the significance of nature is because of its change, isn't it? If every day was 75 and sunny, we wouldn't even notice it. But because there's change, we notice it. We notice beautiful sunsets and we notice hurricanes. We notice the leaves growing on trees. And now, you know, I always notice it when everything turns green, it seems like overnight. I notice it for a while when I get used to it. The same is true about us. When we can quiet our minds enough, we can see the leaves falling, growing and falling away. We can see the body itself arising and passing away, because that's just what it's doing, isn't it? Mine arose 63 years ago on September 5th, 1955. And it's at that point, a process began of arising and passing away. It's included in it. Life is a death sentence, isn't it? Most people don't want to hear it said that way, but that's the truth. So if life is a death sentence, why worry about it? And maybe I better make the most of today, because it's all going to be over. And if, like Bahia, I'm really worried about the cow, well, he wasn't worried about the cow, but he knew that the end could come at any minute, it's time to take to the Dhamma. And we shouldn't do it from a morbid point of view, like, oh, I'm going to die, I better get through this. Just an understanding is that the Buddha, and I'll conclude with this, the Buddha's last words in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta were, impermanence and decay are relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Your own awakening. It's up to us. And then he passed. His last words could have been anything. It could have been, guess what? I exist and I do not exist after death. Ha ha ha, goodbye. His last words were, take to the Dhamma and awaken. Time goes by quickly. Dukkha is immediate. Awakening is too. Thank you. So any questions about this talk, or even in connection with last week's talk? Yes, Debbie.
I just wondered if you could go back and, if it's possible, and repeat that part you were talking about when you say to yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
Oh.
Could you just say something like I will do?
Yeah, well, the Buddha taught often. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is another one. I'm only going to say that, you might want to look it up. There's some talks on it too. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is this, Anatta is not self. So it's the sutta on the not self characteristic, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And in that sutta, the Buddha describes how we form an idea of a self rooted in ignorance, but then he teaches us how to get out of it. And it has to do with an understanding of the impermanent nature. So the idea of saying that this physical form is me and it's all that I'm going to be, or the way that I feel is how I describe myself, or now getting a little bit further afield in the development of ignorance, my perceptions of the world are now how I describe myself, leading to creating assumptions which drive mental fabrications, which drive or motivate how I live in the world. They're the power behind my actions or fabrications. And all of that is rooted in this consciousness that itself is rooted in ignorance. So the in the I can't think of the sutta now. I think it's the Papa Sutta, the Loka Sutta, where the Buddha describes. And I'm taking a long way around to answer your questions, but I'll get to it directly, or I'll answer it directly when I get to it. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, craving the moisture. So it's our ongoing thinking that provides the sustenance for suffering to arise in, or if we got good seeds rooted in the Dhamma, then we can diminish our suffering. So in that impermanence, when we find ourselves identifying ourselves as form, to just remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not who I am, this is not myself, this is not me. And the most immediate time to practice that is when we find ourselves reacting, but that doesn't mean in just a negative way, meaning only when we're upset or sorrowful or angry, but also recognize when we won the lottery or the pot of gold appeared. To not identify with that. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Ultimately, what we're training our minds to do is as phenomena arises and passes away, and phenomena can be our own thought, it's not just something that's appearing. As phenomena arises and passes away, to have a mind that is continually of that view, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Meaning that there's no longer clinging or attachment rooted in craving. There's no longer moisture being provided to thinking rooted in ignorance or consciousness. Did that answer your question? Yeah. So eye making is the primary problem. You know, another eye making is another word for anatta. It's another word for the five clinging aggregates. It's another word for karma. It's another word for ignorance. It's all part of that, just using different words to describe eye making. And it's to a mind that is rooted in ignorance, it's nearly, I'm debating whether using the word nearly impossible or impossible. Since I'm not 100% sure that it's impossible, I'll say nearly impossible to recognize that you're stuck in ignorance. How would you? We need a directed way of recognizing our own ignorance. That's the profound thing that the Buddha awakened to, and it's what's lost in much of modern Buddhism because of the dismissal or the adaptation to dependent origination. Upon the Buddha's awakening, he declared that it is out of ignorance that suffering arises. That's dependent origination. So the solution is wisdom, isn't it? That's what the Buddha's path is called, the path of wisdom. It's developing knowledge through our own efforts where there was once ignorance. So I go from not understanding who I am in relation to the world to understanding who I am in relation to the world by understanding dukkha. Because it's all contained in it. That's why the Buddha started his teachings with saying dukkha occurs. It's almost, it couldn't be emphasized enough. You could write it in the biggest, boldest letters with neon signs, exclamation points. Dukkha occurs! Dukkha occurs! Dukkha occurs! Of course, the Buddha wouldn't want to be that emphatic and distracting by saying that. But to make the point that that's the common problem. It's the essential problem. And when we understand, remember the Salatha Sutta, when we understand our contributions to our own suffering through developing wisdom, then we simply stop contributing to our own suffering. And it really is that simple. It's our choice. And it's a choice that's rooted in knowledge, not rooted in ignorance. And so the result of that is awakening. It's not furthering ignorance. Thanks for the question. Again, excuse the long answer. Any other questions about these suttas? There's going to be one more next week, by the way.
Well, Judy. So it all, I mean, what's dawning on me today, duh, finally, is that it's all about impermanence. The whole thing, I mean, I just understood self and the not self, that's why there's no self, because we're continually changing and becoming, hopefully, choosing to go one way or the other, but we're never the same as we were. There is no now, because now when I just said that, that's past.
That's gone.
So it's all, everything is the permanence.
Yes!
What it comes to.
Yes. You are now Anacondana. The one who understands. I'm being a little bit silly, and but that's it. You've described awakening. That's the whole point. And Judy, that's a great realization that you have.
Thank you. You explained everything today in a way that, after all this time, finally planted that seed in my head. The seed exploded in my head. That's what it is.
Thank you for giving me the credit. Please give yourself the credit for doing the work, because you have. You've integrated the Dhamma well enough to understand that. Look at it this way. 2 years ago, if I said what I just said, you might not have ever come back, because it would have sounded like nonsense. But when you've cultivated the field of your karma by planting the right seeds. Consciousness is the seed, karma is the field. Remarkable, and it really is that simple.
Can I just say, I've got this from your talk today, the Buddha, the expression leaving the world behind. I've got that. I never really fully understood it, but he means in all sensual ways and pleasures and not pleasures, and to just is not attached to it. He's left the world behind in that sense, and I've never really understood that phrase before, but I get
now
that.
You do.
So
we've both had a good one.
Yeah.
It is. That's remarkable. And it's through the sixth sense base, through sensory input, that craving and clinging is established, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's not
until you're awakened.
Yes, and that, to some people who don't understand the Dhamma, even that sounds like kind of a mystical or mysterious, at least, thing to say. But when you realize it, how else would we establish ourselves but through our senses, that we're physical human beings? It's just an obvious thing, isn't it? Except because we're caught in this feedback loop, we don't even realize it, that I see something, I like it, I create an identity by it. And all the other things that we do. Thank you. Was that your comment? Would you like to add anything else to that today?
I just follow on. I just think it's been a great... It's hard to make this all crystal clear. I mean, you describe it in so many ways, but sometimes you just get it clear in your mind. And it's been one of those talks this morning. So, and in the talk you flushed out, you might say, form, feeling, perception, mental fabrications, consciousness, in your talk, that you humanized it even more. I know it's about us and about how we think, but you kind of humanize the thinking behind those words, so you could get it, put it that way, you could just get it a little bit clearer this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it. As I said at the beginning of the talk, that your mind can go, when you have an input through five physical senses of, say, pleasure or something like that, it's hard not to accept the pleasure as being pleasure. It's hard at that moment to pull back and be mindful and think it's, that we've to objectify the pleasure and really see what pleasure is and how much suffering pleasure can cause. Instead of just go, your mind just wants to go with the pleasure. Just enjoy. And just enjoy the moment, have the moment, and forget all the Dharma stuff. It's hard to, when you get out in the world, it's hard to sort of be, choose the right option.
One of the reasons the main reason why the Buddha left the world physically behind, and why he established monasteries somewhat isolated from people, is just that, because he understood the difficulties to those that want to develop the Dhamma in that structured way, which is the Buddha would say it's the most reasonable way, maybe the most effective way, but he didn't teach that that's the only way. So we try to create through our meditation practice something as similar as possible to that, to leaving the world. So that's why I recommend you meditate twice a day, because mm-hmm. at least for 5, 10, 15, 20, or 30 minutes, twice a day, if you're meditating properly, meaning Shamatha Vipassana meditation, you're leaving the world behind in the way that it's meant in the Dhamma. Yeah. You're at least for the time that you're focused on your breath, which might be just for a moment or two, you are disconnected from the world. You are no longer clinging to the world when you're mindful of your breath. That's why we use it. The other aspect that what you and Judy just said, that you had such a powerful understanding through today's teaching, it's not because I'm such a great teacher. That's part of it. When I hear something like that, I always think about Ananda, who was you've heard me say this a thousand. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin, was there for almost every sutta the Buddha ever gave, for every sutta in the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. And Ananda had a word perfect memory, likely because of his deep meditation and concentration practice. The significance of that is it was mostly because of Ananda that we still have the suttas preserved today, because he was able to recount them. All that, with all the Ananda's knowledge, he didn't awaken until a month after the Buddha passed. And yet he heard every teaching the Buddha ever gave. It simply was that his field wasn't cultivated enough yet. But it doesn't matter, does it? Ananda was pretty upset when the Buddha died and he heard that there's going to be a council and only Arahants could come, and he knew he wasn't one of them yet. And so out of that anger and frustration that he wasn't going to be there, he put all his right effort into his meditation practice. And a month later he had that realization that he was, and it's the significance of that is we probably wouldn't have the Buddha's teachings if that didn't occur. And again, the whole point of that, in my another long speech, is it doesn't matter how long it takes, because we don't know. What does matter is right effort. That's why it's the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. And if we're engaged in right effort, we don't have to concern ourselves with when, because we've taken refuge. We know it will happen. And that occurs pretty quickly once we've fully committed to Dhamma practice. We usually have that realization that we're on the right path when we start practicing the right path. Now, I spent many years in modern Buddhism wondering where the hell the path was. Thank you. These realizations come. That's why I run these classes this way, by the way. Instead of we just meditate, maybe once in a while I'll give a little talk, because it's this repetitiveness that is necessary to awaken, and that's really why I do this. I've had quite a few people. I just got an email 2 days ago from someone that used to come, and he said, I thought about coming back, but you just talk too damn much. Okay, I mean, I understand that. In fact, I think about that. I don't want to talk too much, but if I'm going to teach the Dhamma, I have to teach the Dhamma. And the only way I do that, sometimes I talk too much. That's the way it is. Anthony, I hope I'm not talking too much for you today.
No. I'm enjoying this. It's a really good good meeting today. And I was thinking about what you said, and I think that it not only applies to stress that the Buddha said to put off those don't think about the existential questions. What's important is engaging in the practice now. That applies to almost everything, right? Like
absolutely
happiness. Don't think that getting the big car and saving for the house is going to make you happy. It pretty much goes down the line and applies to everything, and living your life in the moment that you're in and not projecting ahead to what could be that would make things better.
Yeah, that's it.
And I was thinking about what you said, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Is that it?
Yeah.
That the important thing there is not to try to figure out who me, mine, and myself is, because that's always changing.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of people say, who am I? It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You just want to recognize that you're not definable, that you're just an ever-changing make of or person in process.
Yeah, and that question, who am I, when it's a self-reflective question, is trying to establish yourself in some permanent way, isn't it? And so let go of the question. It's that question. And so those great existential questions can be really boiled down to what am I or why am I? You know, that's the ultimate question. And it's that underlying question that we maintain. It's that underlying question that creates constant stress.
Yeah.
Where am I in this?
So like a lot of the really, you know, feelings start to churn up for me next to my phone. Because, you know, as a lawyer, you're always engaging in arguments with people.
Yeah.
And so I have like this little card I put there. It's this stop. It's got a big stop sign. And it's a stop, take a breath, observe, pull in some perspective.
Wow.
And I have a little owl next to that because when I see the owl, I ask myself, who? Like an owl says, who? So who's coming to the phone? Because I want to make sure it's the right person. And those are like my reminders to not get into too much into my head.
Yeah, that's training yourself towards right view. That's wonderful. Those are great tips. That's what we do. That's a mind inclined towards awakening.
It's a mind inclined towards not fighting.
Being in your profession, it emphasizes conflict. I mean, it has to. That's the nature
of it. That's how people win and lose.
Yeah, and it can't be any different, and at least in the structure that we have. And so the only thing that can improve the profession is to have people that are lawyers that are actually mindful, isn't it?
Yeah, because you actually do better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's without a doubt. Good for you. Thank you, Anthony.
John, could you turn the air on?
Yes. Got a little stuffy.
People don't mind.
No, I don't.
Oh, good. I was just blown away by today. I kind of said what I needed to say about the teaching. Thank you very much.
And, so glad you're here this morning.
Yeah, me too.
Andrew, good to see you.
See you. Both the sutta and the Vajragatha sutta were, in my mind, really re-accessible to apply to our lives, unlike some other of the suttas I've heard. So it's been very helpful. And now that Judy has gotten it.
Well, watch out.
Since I see her every day. She'll be a good team coach too.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. I feel like my practice lately has just kind of been going through the motions. But this is the drive here, for some reason, I was exceptionally concentrated and I was actually thinking about just explaining what we were here and to somebody that doesn't know, to people that don't know, much like what you were talking about. And somebody asks us, you know, what are you doing? Sitting on those cushions in Frenchtown. And I was thinking about the four foundations of mindfulness and how we don't, you know, we practice observing our breath so that we can recognize that it's occurring without our direction, without our control. And we observe our feelings so that we can see that they are occurring without our input. And we observe physical sensations arising and passing away so that we can see that they're happening without our direction, regardless of what we do or don't do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of, I don't want to call it a mantra, but the phrase, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, could also be applied there. That's what I was just like thinking of when people are going around the room, is just, as I'm observing my breath, I could say, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Not that I'm saying I should say that, but it's not. And your breath and your feelings and your thoughts, all those things are not me.
But it's okay to remind yourself to have that thought. This is not me, this is not mine,
right,
this is not myself.
Right, yeah. And so it just kind of helps to remember that that practice is always available to come back to, and always something that, I mean, really, you should be doing.
Yeah, it should be. It's a
just
true refuge
all the time, you know. And if it's not, I'm not in a like rigid way, but like, you know, if I'm worrying about something or I'm upset about something, you know, then if I have the time to be doing that, I have the time to be just observing whatever thoughts are arising, whatever feelings are arising, and saying, well, it's not me.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's kind of what happened today.
That's a good happen. You're reminding yourself to be mindful of your mind.
Right. Yeah.
Which is, you know, another way of saying we eventually gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, which means we gain the ability to act appropriately at all times. We don't create any more stress.
Which requires practice.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But
that's
for me. Like, yeah, you have to be practicing that. It's,
yeah.
It's so counterintuitive. You know, if you're caught up in your thinking, you're not... Our nature is, or at least the nature of anatta, is just to try to think your way out of thinking about, stop thinking about whatever you're thinking about.
Yeah,
try to think your way out of not thinking.
The seventh line of dependent origination points to that. The anatta is only concerned with maintaining anatta. It's not interested in change or really growth or anything else except growth that feeds anatta. It abhors impermanence. In fact, it can't exist within an understanding of impermanence, you know, these wrong views. So that's, you know, that's where we're going with this, to simply think realistically. And that's, it was I'm not saying we should only use logic, but the logic you use to get to that point is framed well by the Dhamma. So thank you. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
So I wanted you to go back to that not myself, because I think that's going to be a really helpful, it's almost like a cognitive strategy for me, you know, kind of fits in with my training, you know, because I was sitting in a session the other day with a client and saying, you know, can you have that compassionate detachment in terms of reacting to parents or something, can you have that, you know, tell yourself this is not about me. You know, it's kind of a similar kind of thing, you know, because if I do that, it also, in relationship, brings me to compassion, because I'm detaching myself, and therefore, I can be with the other person in a different way that brings compassion, and so that all pulled together to me with what I've been working with myself and clients, too, so it's real integrative. Thank you.
And it is just that practical. On our retreats, I always cover these three suttas, meaning the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and the Fire Discourse. Those are the first three teachings the Buddha ever gave. And those three suttas really explain all of this, including this not-self characteristic. And those talks are from last year's retreat are on the website, too. I think all three were given last Saturday. I give them on usually Saturdays anyway on retreat, if you have, you know, 7, 8, 10 hours to kill, you could listen to those talks. So, or at least the one on the Anatta Lakana Sutta, I think you'd find it helpful. Well, yeah, our retreat is less than 2 weeks away, a week from Thursday. There's still some space. There was another announcement, but I can't remember. Couldn't be all that important. But we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of your in-breath and your out-breath. And be mindful of the arising and passing away of all things. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Next week's class is going to be on the Malankyaputta Sutta, which is similar to these, you know, it's one, another one.
Say
of,
that again?
The Malankyaputta. It's on these great questions again in a little bit different way that the Buddha addresses it. Malankyaputta.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.